art, culture, politics, activism. Now, art in the pandemic age. Have you ever wondered why artists do what they do? What is their purpose? What are they trying to accomplish? I'm your host, Kyle Roman. Welcome to Artivism Now. Artivism, defined, is a portmanteau word combining art and activism. How is it that artists push the boundary of their medium? How do they move societies forward? How do they resolve issues in their neighborhoods, both local and worldwide? These questions are what we set out to answer by interviewing artists locally and the world over. We will get answers to those questions that artists put out there in the community.
Welcome back to season two of Artivism Now. I am your host, Kyle Roman. Today, we welcome Spencer Wilkinson, filmmaker, documentarian, who's bringing the feature Alice Street to the festival circuit. All right, we are here back with Spencer Wilkinson. Welcome back to the program, Spencer. Nice to have you.
Hey, it's great to be back, Kyle. Thanks so much for the opportunity to be back on Artivism.
Absolutely, absolutely. We can't wait to get into it. We have a lot of updates from the project we were talking to you last time, the Alice Street documentary. You were part of the CRP Bay Area series on the podcast, and Desimundo put us in touch with you, and we had you on, and you told us the story of Alice Street, which really kind of gave us the historical context that led to the Ascendance mural and all that was accomplished there. Maybe just if you can for a little bit, just walk us through, like, give me the us and the audience the general essence of Alice Street, the documentary.
Sure. Well, two muralists form an unlikely partnership to paint the largest mural they've ever attempted in downtown Oakland, which is the, center of gentrification in that city. And the mural really represents the diverse cultural arts and artists that have historically resided at that particular intersection, which is 14th and Alice Streets downtown. And, they go through years to actually get the work together, do the research necessary to paint this thing. And literally as the paint is drying on the wall, they find out that a condominium, a luxury condo, is planned to be developed in the plot of land that they painted the mural, which would obscure all four walls. And they find out about this, and the community really decides to rise up and to fight back against this development.
Yeah, and it's so crazy how there's certain subjects over the course of this program and just over, the course of anyone's, creative endeavor that just gets you going, right? And I don't know what it is, but I hear the words Alice Street, and I hear the name of the mural, right, is universal language that went up there. Alice Street is the documentary because it's about everything surrounding the mural and the culture right there, right? But it just gets me going. It's just one of those subjects that if you've been through the history and heard it directly from you guys who were involved in it, and you get surrounded by it, it just infuses you. It literally makes you want to do, like you said, other people were doing at that time is rise up and, you know, fight for public art wherever we need to fight for it. So, and Alice Street, the documentary, is a story that you put together with others, documenting the process of design for that mural. And then the whole situation with the development pops up out of nowhere, right? And that's kind of like the documentarians, you know, if you weren't there with the camera ready to tell a story, that part of the story would never have been told, unless it was by, regular media. So, recap for us, and maybe people didn't hear the previous episode, what was it like to be there when that type of a high level gentrification issue popped up when you had your cameras rolling?
Well, I think, being part of, in a sense, kind of a fly on the wall with the muralists as they were designing this mural and the deep dive they did into the community, I saw how much they had invested in telling the story right. And from the outset, their intention and the goal was really to create an artwork that also was about the resilience of the community, taking into account that, downtown was going through massive changes and development was kind of the hot button topic for Oakland. So knowing that intention and that they'd kind of, even consulted with the city and gotten people involved on different levels who supported this artwork all the way from the, mayor on down, had known about this project, I think that it came at a big surprise that on one hand, they're, the city supporting this, epic mural telling the story of this very important history of cultural arts in downtown. And at the same time, the planning department is giving this green light for developers to develop in front of it. It just kind of shows the hypocrisies within cities where they're literally, investing in some respects, some funding too, in painting this thing. And at the same time, their main approach for surface level parking lots in Oakland has been develop, build. So I think, it came as a big surprise, a big disappointment. But I think what mostly impressed me was the community's response. Because as soon as word went out, the first meeting planned by the developers to reach out to the community, people showed up, and they were there every step of the way, kind of speaking out, and not in a belligerent way, but in a way that was very direct, and which was expressing what they felt they would be losing here. And it's not just actually the mural. The mural is a piece of what they resisted around. It was also the concerns around developing right across from these very important community centers and how that would impact the artists who operate out of there and the culture that's expressed in those centers.
Yeah, that's so true. And both yourself and Desi alluded to that kind of like ripple effect in our episodes in season one. And one of the, at the very least, positive ripple effects from that situation that Desi had talked about it are the community coalitions that were built around rising up. And like you said, it wasn't like a belligerent rise up or anything. These weren't people who were just, shouting from the sidelines. These were people who were active. They were at city council meetings, they were at development meetings, they were hearing face to face, criticism from city officials and development officials and offering their viewpoint back in a very constructive and like you could honestly see a little bit of like Hamilton and Washington and like taking it back to the beginning of democracy in this country in a lot of those meetings. Like there was just a very high level of discourse that is, it proved a lot of different results later on too. And so the Alice Street led to many coalition or a lot of coalition building within the public art community and the cultural communities of Oakland. And they led to certain agreements, right, that came from this. And would you be able to walk us through what those community agreements were?
For sure, yeah. And it kind of evolved, like you said, like there's different cultural groups that form coalition. Started with the Malanga Cascalord Center for the Arts, and they had their representatives connect with Oakland Chinatown Coalition, who, you know, have a history of fighting for, you know, benefit agreements and things like that, and they're very active in the Oakland Chinatown community. So initially there were representatives from these two kind of groups that joined together to look at, you know, what can we do really about a development that's planned? You know, I mean, these guys have all the money, in some respects, a lot of power, and a green light from the city. What do we, as everyday folks, what can we do? So first it started out with this kind of these two coalitions, and then it became the Black Arts Movement Business District, which is an entire kind of like a new jurisdiction in downtown Oakland, pretty much along the 14th Street corridor. There's a body there of folks that are very active in the community as well. And then I think it kind of evolved from Malanga Center to really being folks from that organization that joined with Oakland Chinatown Coalition and formed the CCED, which is a Community Coalition for Equitable Development. And that was the body that really represented these diverse constituents fighting for, in particular, community benefit agreements.
That interruption really restarted an entire process of defining the whole downtown plan by equity.
Your team should reflect the makeup of the city, and it doesn't. Every single speaker here is white. We are working towards a multiracial agenda that's about empowering everyone in Oakland. There's hardly anyone from the Fruit Belt here. There's hardly anyone from Deep East Oakland, West Oakland. These are people impacted by displacement.
Development is such a tricky thing. Our city has not wanted to be bold in asking for what we want and what we need.
What makes Oakland beautiful is the diversity and its arts. I don't think the city really get it. Who we have to really move forward the people's agenda.
Increasing, and it's pushing Black folks out, it's pushing Asians out, it's pushing Latinos out.
We're here to fight, we're here to stay, we're not leaving, we're not going away.
People protect what we have. I just don't understand the logic of City Hall to not see that.
Which, you know, before this whole kind of project, I did not know what that was.
Right.
You know, the idea that you can ask developers who want to build, you know, luxury condos in your neighborhood for tangible benefits for the community was kind of a foreign concept to me. But it has precedent, you know, this has happened and is actually even part of city policies around the country. And someone who's really knows a lot about this and is also featured in Alice Street pretty heavily is Leilan Sandra Huen. She's got a long history of fighting around housing activism, and she, I have to give props to her because she really led this coalition in a big way. She knew about what other cities had done. She'd in fact done this multi-city study around what communities were doing around gentrification and toured the country, learning about models, and brought that back to Oakland. Yeah. So she, you know, because this is like a lot of artists, a lot of community members who just have a feeling that this isn't right, you know, or, you know, some concerns, but they didn't really know necessarily, you know, how to channel it. Leilan provided a lot of leadership in this instance and, you know, said, look, we need to file an appeal right away. It's going to require money, you know, and that it's, you know, these things that you learn about, you know, when these issues come up, it's like, we've got to raise, you know, $3,000 in, I think in like a week. And they did it. They actually did a crowdfunding campaign, and enough people were, you know, involved and energized around this topic and issue. They raised the money, they got the appeal in time, and then they got to be able to sit at the table with developers, you know, show up at these city council meetings, enforce, know what they needed to ask for, et cetera. And yeah, that resulted in the first community benefit agreement, which was about $500,000 from that developer on 14th and Alice Street. In exchange for them developing their project, they would provide $500,000 in community benefits. And that looked like restoration of the Malanga Casco Lord Center for the Arts, some funds towards some important restoration projects. Yeah. It represented repainting the mural, which was, you know, became the Ascendance mural, which obviously you did a deep dive into. Yeah. And it represented parking spaces being provided, and a couple other things as well that are, you know, kind of escaping me, but very tangible community benefits from that first project. And then they used that model and did the same thing at, you know, three or four other massive developments that were going on in downtown, and used that model to really engage those other developers and win other community benefit agreements, which totaled a very significant amount of money. But really what that looked like is also low-income housing units, which the city hasn't really had strong enough teeth around ensuring that these new developments have low-income housing included. So that was another part of their whole strategy, is using these negotiations with developers to get more low-income housing and retail spaces that were made available for the local community. It was significant. And, you know, and a model, I think, too, in that regard.
Well, and when you talk about it, and when I've heard Desi talk about it, it seems almost like there's, and, you know, I don't want to come off as, you know, maybe excusing or erasing the actions for what they were by the developers, and there's some outright cutthroat developers, and there's some outright, you know, people who are literally out there to gentrify, to clear places so that they could have their wealth, right? But it almost sounds like there's definitely an education process that has gone on there from the community on up. Like, there hasn't been a complete, you know, wall built between former Oakland and new Oakland. It almost sounds like there's a little bit of an education process that needs to happen, at least in the situation in Oakland, and in other cities, you know, maybe it's not as successful on the education side, but everybody who I hear speak, just like Leilan, like, there's a lot of people that really just pop in that documentary, right? She is one of them. Desi is one. Theo is another one, right? They're just these people who are just, they're larger in life in their passion for this subject of public art, gentrification, and like really democracy. They're really models of democratic citizens. And it just seems, I just thought I'd, you know, throw it out there. Like, there's an awful lot that these developers and these city officials have to learn from the culture and the community members. And Oakland is displaying that for everyone. I just think that's fascinating, you know?
It is. Your reflection on the story, as well as like these individuals and their contribution, is right on. You know, it took people really raising their voice and just kind of asking for these benefit agreements. If they hadn't asked, the developers wouldn't have provided them, because the city also doesn't have a policy, which they should, which involves community benefit agreements. And I think, you know, I've heard Leilan speak since, you know, this story came out about how there's a lot of cities around the country that have models, Philadelphia, for example, I think has a really strong community benefit agreement policy in place. So that when new developers come into the city, they're already knowing that they're providing this certain level of funding towards existing communities, so they don't just kind of displace people and gentrify with, you know, raising rents and, creating these big impacts on the local market. You know, so there's models out there, and there's a lot to learn, I think, city to city, community to community. And, you know, Oakland's lucky to have these really vocal and strong community members who sacrifice a lot of their time to show up at these meetings and ask for, you know, and organize around what they're asking for. But really, the city should already have that in place. You know,
right.
It shouldn't be this massive sacrifice of community members to do that work. You know, it should be. It should be just something that the city, you know, prioritizes. And I think it's been tough to really have these kind of policies be passed and to not, I think there was a big fear in Oakland for many years that developers wouldn't come and that, you know, they needed to kind of roll out the red carpet for anyone with investment capital, you know, because for a long time there wasn't much in terms of development. And so, you know, I think it's a bigger topic and a bigger, you know, historical continuum at play. To see these folks really, really come together, really stand up and do the hard work to get these things was super inspiring.
That's where we started creating a coalition between some of us in the Chinatown Coalition and folks at Malanga. There's been a historic rift between the Asian American community and the Black community. It was really the mural that actually brought this coalition together.
I mean, I don't think it would have happened without the mural. The mural was absolutely the catalyst for all these things that happened.
With that appeal we delivered to the city, we started a process where people begin to understand that developers should create community benefits agreements.
And then almost immediately after that, we had to jump into these other negotiations because they were happening at the same time.
What started with the mural actually led to a movement.
That movement went on to negotiate community benefit agreements with developers with an estimated value of $20 million.
With all four projects, we won about $20 million in community benefits agreements. Over 90 affordable homes, 13,000 square feet of affordable retail space for neighborhood businesses, $500,000 for anti-displacement, commitments to retail advisory boards and a public art advisory board, and neighborhood participation in development decisions.
Community benefit agreements are a vital and effective tool, and it's beyond the money. It is the framing of a relationship and to actually demand that, no, we need to talk about how you're going to be a part of our community.
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult to watch an excerpt or the full run of the show without wanting to get up off your couch and go and do something or research something, or, you know, put your feet to the pavement and get out there like, you know, CRP does, and advocate, like, and that's how you know that there's a great and inspiring story there, and B, that it's been documented and covered and retold so well. And, you know, that can, you know, that's kind of, you know, what else we'd like to talk about today, right? Is like you as the documentarian being able to retell this story in such a palatable way, and yet still keep the capture the stunning visualization of the art and the culture in that area, while also still being able to not only capture the macro, but also you know, the micro and the stillness and the individual hit that people take with this type of a situation. I think it's fascinating how you're able to blend that as a media artist, as a filmmaker. And you know, if we could speak to the art form for a little bit, how is it, you know, how much of a task do you see that being when you have this story unfolding that's so wide in scope, yet it's the intimate moments that really can capture and a person in the audience. How difficult is that to balance those two composition wise?
That's a great question. It is a challenge because it's a vast story, like you said, and there's so many kind of sub plots and characters that you could really follow. Making choices throughout in how to tell the story was a very involved process. And, you know, I'd be remiss to say that it was, you know, my process alone, because it was a very much a team project. We had multiple editors come into the project at times. I did a fair amount of the edit, you know, for the film, but we brought in a finishing editor, John Ayons Alonso, who was incredible in helping to kind of really structure things from an outside point of view, you know, seeing what was there, seeing what really rose to the surface. Because sometimes I think this was a 6-year long process for me in working on this film, from the beginning of our, you know, first day of shooting until, you know, we wrapped everything up. So in a sense, I was so intimately connected to the story that in some ways it's hard to kind of see the big picture. You need other folks to give feedback. You know, we went through many rounds of feedback. We had community screenings and received feedback in that way. You know, very talented and creative people who gave input, who also provided some kind of contextualizing the story. We had someone who created a whole graphics aspect of like a map of Oakland where you could follow kind of, you know, traveling through the city and finding different scenes, which was an important kind of technique to use. But yeah, you know, it takes a lot of whittling down, you know, hundreds of hours of content, coming up with a structure and then revamping it over and over and over again until you finally get to, you know, what seems to really work. And then you get feedback, which tells you it really doesn't, or what parts do and don't. And you have to stay pretty humble through it, you know, and realize that it is a community effort all the way through. It was from the outset, a community effort all the way up until the end. And that was very important, to make sure that it wasn't just one person's perspective and storytelling. It really was an entire community of folks that contributed to it.
And when you bring that part up, that makes it seem even more of just like a pie in the sky notion that this thing could ever come together, right? But you're absolutely right, because the creative, my medium is theater arts, and so I know that it is a team effort. Like, I literally cannot have my hand in every single jar that there is, right? And so I get that, but my brain is thinking, this is all on film and I can only be in so many places. Who's going to be there? And who's, I can't even conceive of it. That's why it just seems so, in reality. And I hope that people will get to the point where they will talk about where they could find Alice Street, the documentary. And then we could talk about release and everything like that too. But when you see the documentary, you're going to see such an effortless story be told and unfold before your eyes. And it's going to have all the elements of a great story, both macro and micro. It's going to have stillness and movement to it. And yet the pain and the tears and the agony and the, and I'm not saying these things to discourage artists, like literally artists, we're all like that, right? Like, there's a certain amount of pain that you have to deal with, but the ability for something to be so palatable, so well understood, and so macro and micro balanced in terms of its composition, it's such an amazing feat. So, I guess I'm saying in long form, like, you guys, you and your team should be immensely proud of this. And I know that you are. And, but there's an intense amount of pride that you can tell went into this when you watch it.
Well, thank you for that. I think it's different. What I'm learning is that, a narrative film is written out from beginning to end, and there's a very clear sense of story. Documentary, you're just kind of showing up, and you're showing up repeatedly, and you're documenting along the way. And there's a story there, and at some point, it kind of reveals, okay, we have something here. But
yeah,
in terms of structure, there's no set kind of, at least in the way, I work, and I'm sure there's a million different ways to approach this kind of thing. But, we just had all of these amazing interviews and incredible side stories, and to decide what would make, the final film and what would, was definitely a process. We did get an original score written for this film as well by an incredible composer named Micah Barrick, who added so much, in our sound mix by his brother, James Barrick, down in Hollywood, was phenomenal. So many different artists who put their, and that was honestly not painful and agony for me at all. Yeah. It was really, the joyful part is like, let these artists come into this project and just do their thing, and that's, there's a bit of a push pull there with wanting to be involved in every, micro decision, and then also really letting people just work and show their creative genius. And working as a team, is that's a big part of it.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm glad, that it was received well by you, that for you, it feels effortless. That's definitely the intention of, what you hope for. Right.
Yeah, seamless project. And now we can get into, where is it that we can see Alice Street at this point? Last time I talked to you, we were looking at an August date for the Newport Beach Film Festival. You had a little bit of an update. that you wanted to share with that. Let's talk about that.
For sure. Well, you know, as we've all experienced, this year has just been anything but predictable, right? And the idea of releasing a film in the midst of COVID has been...
I can't imagine.
You know, kept us on our toes. And it's a new media landscape. It's a new, there's a lot to learn in this virtual kind of film festival experience. But, you know, we've been, I think I was really surprised and excited by the reception of the film. Alice Street first was shown in the end of August in Brighton, in the UK, at Brighton Rocks Film Festival. And then there's been a bunch of others since then. You know, we were in just in Oakland International Film Festival, and we are also currently in what's called the Social Change Film Festival, which typically would be a Chicago, LA, New York festival, but obviously virtual, so it's in the sense it's global. We just played at Urban World in New York City, which is a phenomenal festival, I think the largest in the world that really focuses on multicultural films. They have a massive scope, incredible films that were part of the festival this year. And so to have Alice Street there was just amazing. We are going to starting Newport Beach today through the 11th of October. It got postponed and postponed again, but here we go.
All right.
Mill Valley Film Festival is next week, which is going to be amazing. My first film, One Voice, played in Mill Valley 2 years ago in 2018. So it's going to be great to return. They program so many incredible films. And, you know, I think the oldest and largest film festival in California, or maybe one of the top three, something like that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and then we're going to be in Milwaukee. We're going to be in Calgary for the Marta Loop Film Festival. We're going to Doc Utah. I think, you know, a bunch of others. We also had an incredible screening at the Haiti Heritage Film Festival, which wasn't an official selection. It was a special presentation of the story that they did out in Durham, North Carolina. So it's been getting a fair amount of, you know, traction and in the festival world. So, you know, I think we're just riding the wave right now and just really, really appreciative for these opportunities to have this story be seen in, you know, a bunch of different communities around the country right now. So.
Yeah, and your team and yourself especially just have that just natural knack for humility in your art form for the communities that you tell their stories, and that's something I feel like you guys are now reaping the blessings of that humility, you know. And it's a great lesson because, you know, a lot of the people who listen to the program are art students or even some of my students. And it's a great lesson for an artist to carry themselves a certain way with humility, to being a humble person, both within your art form and in your own life in general. And honestly, the Alice Street film is seen. Like I can't remember the last day where there hasn't been like a new festival update on Instagram from Alice Street Film. And if you're on Instagram, you got to check out Alice Street Film, right? Is the official Instagram of the movie. And there's all the festival updates on there. You just kind of flip back through the grid there, and follow them, follow Alice Street Film. They're documenting their own, festival blessings going on right now. And you could see where you could catch the film if you're in that specific area. And, I think the great thing too, is you guys, it was able to, get some overseas play, right? Which is always huge, because there's always a lot of reception for American inner city stories and in other countries for whatever reason. I feel like it communicates a certain truth that's not out there globally about the nation that we live in, you know? And so when something like Alice Street can communicate its message outwards to internationally, you know, honestly, I feel like, it does the diplomatic job that even our own diplomats can't do sometimes, which is show these amazing stories of a diverse population in America rising up for their community. And, honestly, I don't want to, jump too far into, hyperbole or whatever you want to call it. But I honestly feel like the Alice Street film puts such a great face on American diversity, American cultural pride within that diversity, from the Black community, from the Asian American community, and from the artist community within Oakland. And it's telling, a great American story. And I can't keep fawning all over it too much, but I mean,
I don't mind at all.
I just feel like that's something that's just an unintended blessing that you guys and your team has been able to provide, just in general, a great outlook on how amazing American culture could be if people committed themselves like this in some of our great cities, you know?
Yeah, I appreciate it, all that you said there. And these artists, existed there before the film and will exist there long after the film is complete, right? And mm-hmm. these communities have been in existence and resilient and fighting for recognition for decades and decades. So if the film can help to shine a light on these incredible individuals and their stories, I think, that's what I really hope for, is this level of introduction and the level of that the story can help lift up these mm-hmm. cultural artists that have worked so hard to be who they are and where they are, and it's amazing that they kind of allowed themselves to be part of the story and part of the film. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, the issues continue and the struggle continues. So I think what I'm excited about too with the story is that it can be a tool for like you said, illuminating these stories and illuminating these folks, and also serving as a model for communities that are, experiencing similar issues. Because a lot of American cities, especially now, right, with COVID and the economy, the struggle is real, and the gap is widening between the wealthiest mm-hmm. and those that don't have, mm-hmm. So much unemployment. People need hope and they need models. And I think that, I'm hoping that this film can really be at least some level of inspiration. And we actually, I didn't mention, but we got a wonderful grant from the California Arts Council to bring the film around the state in communities impacted by gentrification and do screenings. Pre-COVID, it was, looking like indoor screenings with amazing panels and performances. Now we're pivoting, as everyone is having to, right? Yeah. And we're thinking about outdoor screenings, but more mm-hmm. kind of street level, projecting on walls, they did to project the images for the mural, and projecting on walls that are significant to the issues. Every community has their Alice Street, and so we want to find that place, show the film, have outdoor screenings, dialogue, and do that. So we're planning a tour in early 2021, in springtime, to do a series of outdoor screenings of the film and foster dialogue, you know, like this, where people are sharing ideas.
That's fabulous.
You know, thinking about models that can be supportive to their community. And then, you know, brand new news that we can share as well. Literally today, we found out from the San Francisco Foundation, also kicked in a significant grant to help the film be a tool for impact. And so that'll continue its kind of journey and ability to really be a way that people can kind of create this dialogue going. So, you know, it's been wonderful. You know, you spend so much time on these projects, you don't know where they're going to go. And having this support right now it's humbling and it's moving, you know, it's ongoing community building. You know, that was the initiation, that was the intention, and it continues to be that, you know, as it rolls into this new phase of getting out in the world. So, you know, I'm glad you're having art students, you know, listen to conversations with artists and, you know, hopefully be inspired. And, you know, and definitely it's a humbling journey. And even now it's a ton of work, but it's very rewarding to see something that you really put a lot of energy into be kind of shared, you know, and be used potentially as a tool towards the issues that you care about. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the teacher in me is just, when you're talking about the California Arts Council and then City of San Francisco and, you know, putting projectors on walls and meaningful walls, and it's just like the symbolism that's there. And this kind of popped up with the conversation I had this last week with a gentleman, DJ Luz, stencil artist from Bogota, Colombia, and his art form, and how it doesn't matter what the wall looks like or where the wall is, his stencil is going to stand out and represent and everything. And I'm just thinking, like, how is it that we can thank COVID at any level, the pandemic at any level, right? Because of the atrocities and the mismanagement with the healthcare and all of that we have to blame in this situation, almost feels like you guys were meant, you know, it feels like you were meant to do this in this fashion. You know, it almost feels like it's more meaningful, you know, because I mean, I know crowded theater is great, projector screen, all your technology indoor, everyone's comfortable, the right people show up, the thing can take off, right? But just imagining this on the pavement, projector pointing at wall, I don't know, it just gets me fired up, like this is gonna be 10 to 100 times more of an impact than it would have been, you know? I mean, if we could thank COVID on any level, that's this type of a blessing that's gonna have such a ripple effect down the road. I feel like the conversations had at the ground level, you know, those are the conversations that should have been having, you know, in the first place, right?
That's a good point. You know, I think I've been disappointed in some ways around the, you know, you're not getting that audience feedback that you would in a crowded theater, you know, and if you show up to these festivals and kind of getting that audience reception, you don't even, you know, you just kind of put it out there and you know, you hope it's received well,
right?
And it's a little bit surreal. But, you know, what you brought up in terms of, you know, pivoting and the positive aspects of this are that, you know, there's no limit to the audience when you're doing stuff online, you know, and oftentimes festivals are a very exclusive crowd, you know, or a particular crowd that's interested in film festivals. You know, that's who your audience is. And now I think, you know, these audiences are really broadening. Festivals are experimenting a lot and are reaching totally new you know, populations than they would have normally. And they're coming up with interesting ideas about how to do that. I think too, this idea of doing, you know, street screenings is going to be really cool, you know, and
yeah.
And it does feel different, you know, and
yeah.
They'll be free and they'll be community based. And that's really exciting, is to bring mm-hmm. anybody who might be just walking by, might yeah. sit down and get to, you know, experience an event or an evening. So I think you're right. You know, we're all trying our best to creatively right. respond to the circumstance that we're in. And I think it will, you know, bring something really new to this. You know, we want to come up with something really, you know, unique and engaging
yeah.
and dynamic. So.
Well, I know if you guys want me there, I will definitely cover this. I'll get out there with the microphone and get some audio
put
it out there. And
yeah, you're invited. You're absolutely invited. Yeah.
Lift up these voices. And you know, honestly, like you were talking about the expanding the audience, like anybody who, I mean, even if you're 100 feet away and you see this, you know, movie playing on a wall, and, you know, all you have to hear is the people from the Milonga Center and the drumming, and you're locked in. Like, I don't care who you are, that it's just going to reel you in, right? And then the stories and the faces, you know, and the pain and the angst, like it's just so intensely human of a story that I think that's why people in higher positions, if they have seen excerpts or they've been told the story of it, they're committing to it as an educational tool, because it has that ability to really, you know, like all good art should, connect you on a human level with people that you don't even know, you know?
So, I hope so. Yeah, I mean, that's encouraging to hear. And yeah, it's been, like I said, just kind of humbling to have a strong reception and to feel people see the story as important as, you know, we felt it was
right.
When experiencing it, you know. You don't know how it's going to translate. And so it's right. been really heartwarming to see that translating well, no doubt.
All right, so we have a new project that is going out, right, that you have some information on. It involves KQED. Walk us through that.
Right. Well, we've been working on another documentary project for the last couple of years now, which delves into a dance form that was born in Oakland in the funk era. Mid 60s into the 70s, called the Oakland Boogaloo. Mm. And like I said, we've been following this story for the last couple of years, and we'll be producing a very short piece for KQED coming up, I think in, you know, near the end of this year. And it's part of a series called If Cities Could Dance, which is, I think, in their third season. They're a phenomenal series. I really recommend, you know, whoever's listening out there, check out
Absolutely.
If Cities Could Dance. It's an introduction into, you know, street dance forms all over the country, and very artfully told. So we're really excited that we have this opportunity to bring to light an important art form that was actually the predecessor of many other dance forms that came after it. So, you know, keep your eye out for it. Coming, I think, in December 2020.
And growing up in the Bay Area, you notice it at the very least, you hear about it, but you notice how unique the city of Oakland is in being like the first at things or developing a new form of something. And dance in Oakland is tied into the fabric of the expression of the East Bay going back. I mean, you're talking about the mid 60s here. And here we are, you know, I mean, I'm no spring chicken and everything. I was born in 1980, but, you know, even the mid 60s, I remember, you know, my dad talking about that being a kid in that era and how vibrant the area was. It's just so interesting and yet not surprising being someone from the East Bay that there is this art form that is still in practice. Now, what is this like 55 years later, if we're talking mid 60s, still in practice and has spurred off other versions of itself and created that, you know, that outward motion within the movement world. I can't even imagine the story behind it. And this is something that you brought up pre-interview that we're talking about. And this is all new to me too. So I can't wait to get into this story, to learn more about the Oakland Boogaloo and its roots and what it's fed into. I can only imagine, because of the bevy of artists, performance artists, right, in Oakland and the East Bay that have become icons, let alone the general everyday artist just walking down the street in Oakland could at any point in time be like at the top of the world because of their talent level. You know, that's just how rich it is. So how is it covering a story like that just has intense roots in the art world going back so far?
I mean, all of these stories honestly are just kind of like tremendous responsibilities. I feel that sense of I don't think it's a self-imposed pressure, but it's a pressure. If you're working with people to help them tell a story, and it has such important significance, it's like you carry it, you know, you carry it around with you on a day-to-day basis, because you can't show up halfway for these stories. And when they are, you know, held with such regard over the course of, in some cases, 50 years. Yeah. You know, the originators and the practitioners have kept this style of dance alive and the culture around it alive for that long. Mm-hmm. So, you know, being an outside person coming in to help folks tell the story is tremendous responsibility. And it's also fascinating, you know, because it's little known and it carries such impact. I mean, in the street dance world, the kind of popping, locking, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. Dance style that many attribute to Los Angeles, New right. York. The originators were Oakland.
Yeah,
the great. Art form comes from Oakland and nobody talks about it. And these guys right. have not gotten their shine. So it's both really exciting to be able to help, you know, get the spotlight where it needs to be, as well as, you know, you feel the pressure, you feel the yeah. responsibility, you know, and these guys let you know, you know, as well. It's not, you know, something I just made up in my head. It's like, no. you know, people are the very decades, serious. Right? They're serious yeah. about their stuff, you know, yeah. and what they came up with. And it's primarily an African-American, community dance. Started with, you know, young people in the, you know, elementary and middle schools in East Oakland yeah. and West Oakland mm. and, you know, spread out to San Francisco and Richmond and on and on and on. It's a tremendous and vast story, but Oakland is really the origin of it. And Oakland is rich. Like you said, there's just yeah. tremendous talent. It's unbelievable it to is. Hear the stories of what Castlemont High School was like in the 60s and 70s, the artists and the caliber that came out of these schools,
yeah.
The arts programs that were also really
yeah.
supportive for the young people at the time. You know, you had a lot of amazing musicians, dancers, singers, et cetera, coming out of these schools. McClyman's High School being a real originator of so many incredible artists. So we could talk on and on about this topic. Right. It's something, you know, that's very interesting to me. But yeah, that's at least a little bit about the story, and, you know, keep your eye out.
And absolutely. So, yeah. Sure. We'll put the link out there as soon as you guys post. You know, we'll put it out there as well. And it's interesting that we've gone to this topic, and this is your project that you're currently working on. And then this season for us, we have multiple movement artists, dancers, choreographers in this season. And so it makes it super unique to the previous season, where it was mostly public artists, muralists, and such, which was its own beast and animal. And you know, those guys are committed. They are just like super intense artists, yet so gracious. And it the pivot this season to a little bit more movement style art is really cool. And I love the fact that's your project as well. Because my wife is a choreographer, you know, I'm a theater person. And so we're both kind of in the movement world, so to speak, the kinesthetic art world. And so I'm looking forward to this. I'm glued. I'm ready for this KQED special. So it's called, if a city could dance,
is that the name? If cities could dance. The series. Yeah. I think they're in maybe their third or fourth season now. They're wonderful. Incredible. Check them out.
So anybody could go on to KQED, possibly either the channel,
even YouTube. Yeah, or even YouTube
has a poster.
Yeah, they're kind of distributed online. They're also nationally kind of lifted up by PBS. Okay. So there's a variety of ways to see it, but YouTube, if cities could dance, YouTube, it's all there. It's all accessible.
Wonderful. And we'll definitely be on the lookout for the Oakland, which I imagine, no offense to any other cities, but I imagine the Oakland one is probably going to stand out a little bit more than the others. It's just, you just know when you talk Oakland and art form, you know, it's going to be super unique, and you know, it's going to be something that is fun and everybody wishes that they could do. So I don't know, maybe that's just me coming from the East Bay and being around it. You know, I'm just there, you know, there's just a lot of pride, right? And you being from Oakland as well. There's just
and I'm not originally from Oakland. I wish I could claim that. But you know, I'm not. But you know, good to hear that you're from the East Bay, and yes, there is so much Oakland pride.
Oh.
You know, and definitely it's contagious. You know, it's my third film I'm making, this feature film on Oakland topic. So, you know, it's contagious, no doubt. And it's amazing to see, you know, the pride that the city has, you know, for its art and for its legacy, activism, et cetera.
Yeah. And I think people from Oakland would say at this point, Spencer, you're seasoned by Oakland. So, you know, that's where right. Yeah, you've just been seasoned by Oakland, and so that makes you part of it, you know, and you're telling the stories, and you know, that not very many people can say that they've been able to do that for a city. And so thank you for doing that, and for all that you do within the art form, and telling intensely human stories. You know, I wish all the best for Alice Street and all the success in the world. And I know I'm going to be using it as part of my teaching moving forward in my classroom, in many different forms. And so thank you for providing educators and artists a story that we can not only identify with, but use to teach the next generation. So thank you.
Well, thank you for this opportunity. You do a great podcast, and it's been a real joy to be part of it. So thank you.
Appreciate that. All right. Thank you very much, sir. take care, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Special thanks to Spencer Wilkinson for joining us once again on season 2 of Artivism Now. You can find him on Instagram at Spencer_Isaac_W. And you can check out his work on his Vimeo site, vimeo.com/endangeredideas. On his Instagram, you could also get updates on the film festival circuit that the documentary Alice Street is currently traveling upon. And remember, artists out there, keep it lit. Let it flow. Let it mean something. And goodbye.